Yeah, we're going to be in Exodus 25. We're going to pick up where we left off last week. Last week we talked about the Ark of the Covenant. And, you know, we're talking about the furniture that's inside of the tabernacle. Now, you know, God is giving Moses basically the engineering of those things. And that's a little bit dry. So what we're doing is we're taking the engineering and we're trying to at least magnify it a little bit as to, you know, why would we make an ark and what's it for? And what about this today, this table of bread, this golden table that holds this bread and, you know, also the menorah, the golden lampstand, you know, what's that all about? And if we don't recognize that these are furniture pieces inside of the tabernacle, then we're really not going to get, you know, what they are and what they represent and you know, exactly why God had Moses construct them and put them in there. Now, you know, let's just start by saying this. These items, all of them, inside of the tabernacle are not unique. Okay, this is not the first time they've been seen by humanity. Okay, most of the time, most Christians feel like they are, because the first 9 verses says, "Hey Moses, you know, I'm going to give you the blueprint. You do it exactly the way I tell you." Well, it says nothing about unique. It just tells Moses, "This is how I want it built, and I want you to stay right, you know, down the middle as far as the dimensions and what it's made of, how it's made, all that sort of thing." We talked about the fact that, you know, as you enter the tabernacle, the court of the tabernacle, we talked about the fact that you've come into contact with metals. The 3 different metals are bronze and silver and gold. And the further you get into the tabernacle, the closer you get to the most holy place, you know, the preciousness of the metal goes up. Okay, to the point where we talked about last week, the lid, the keporet, the keporet, however you want to say that, the lid of the ark is pure gold, okay, because God's feet rest there. I mean, we know that the ark is God's footstool. There's something going on here. We're creating a sacred space, in other words, and this sacred space represents something. And it's that sacred space that is where God and his people meet. They fellowship. In other words, they tabernacle. The word tabernacle means to dwell. They dwell together. Okay? And so if we keep that in mind and we are looking at these objects that are called furniture for the tabernacle, we'll understand better why, you know, God's saying to make these things. But again, they're not unique. Okay? If you look in Egyptian history, you'll see every single one of these things. The interesting thing about them is they're used primarily for the same function, but the function is distorted. Okay, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we talk about these two items we're going to talk about today. But remember, you know, just because God said, "Hey Moses, you know, do this according to this print," it says nothing about being completely unique at all. Now, if you have a Deuteronomy, come on, Mike, a Deuteronomy 32 worldview, okay, so Deuteronomy 32, particularly verses 8 and 9, talks about the fact that at the Tower of Babel, God divorced humanity and then pulled one man out of those nations to redeem him, to make resurrect him and make a people of his own. And he assigned the divine council members over those 70 nations. Well, where did the design of the tabernacle and all the furniture that's inside of it come from? It came from the council room of God. Where did the Elohim that are over all the other nations come from? Same place. So why wouldn't you see articles that match them? Of course you would, because they come from the exact same place.
I just watched an excellent video about that very verse last night.
Well, very good.
Yeah. Michael Heiser, that Celebration Church, and he talked about that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, you know, and the problem is with most Christians, they go out to Middle Earth called the internet, and you know, they listen to the village atheists and the internet PhDs who say, well, look at this, you know, all the only thing the Hebrews did was copy what was already there. No, they didn't, but what was already there came from the same place. And so, you know, it's the same as someone coming and saying, well, you know, there's no such thing as the Trinity. The Trinity is nothing more than, if you look back in history into Mesopotamia, if you look at Ugaritic texts, you'll see that, you know, the gods were split in three, you know, and you'll see that. It's like, well, no, you know, yet you can look at it that way. But if you, again, if you have a worldview that's correct, you'll know that everyone knew the two powers of heaven at the Tower of Babel, and when they dispersed out, that stayed the same. Now, did they get distorted? Yes, but you should see all over the earth, in both art and literature, the fact that God is three. Okay, you should see that. God is one, but yet he's three people. And that's exactly what we do see. And so, you know, that's not a deterrent. You know, that's a confirmation. And the same thing here. Just because you can find an ark in Egyptology, it's not a deterrent. It's a confirmation. Because, you know, God never said, this is unique, this has never been done before, listen to me, Moses. He never said that. He said, here's the pattern. This is what I want you to do. Okay, so let's, we're not going to talk about everything that's in the tabernacle court, but we are going to talk about, we've talked about the Ark of the Covenant, now we're going to talk about two more pieces here. We're going to read, first of all, let me kind of read them in turn here. Exodus 25, 23 through 30 is going to describe this golden table, okay? So here we go. You shall make a table of acacia wood. 2 cubits shall be its length, 1 cubit its breadth, and 1.5 cubits its height. You shall overlay it with pure gold and make a molding of gold around it. And you shall make a rim around it, 1 handbreadth wide, and a molding of gold around the rim, and you shall make it four rings of gold, and fasten the rings to the four corners at its four legs. Close to the frame the rings shall lie as holders for the poles to carry the table. You shall make the poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold, and the table shall be carried with these. And you shall make its plates and dishes for incense, and its flagons and bowls with which to pour drink offerings. You shall make them of pure gold, and you shall set the bread of the presence on the table before me regularly. All right. Praise God for his word. That regularly is very important, okay?
And the bread of the presence is what? It's just the bread offering.
Yeah, yeah, it's bread, and you know we'll read a little bit in Leviticus a little bit more about the bread of the presence, but you know it's baked.
So it's,
yeah, yeah, panim is the word for present. The Hebrew word for present is panim, and well, that's what it means. It means to be before the face of God. Okay, that's what it means. So, in other words, God is here, and so it's the bread of presence. So that's the description of the table for the bread, this bread of presence, and it's mentioned elsewhere in Leviticus. We're gonna go there in just a few minutes, but I want to talk a little bit about the similarity of this and what we've just seen, the Ark of the Covenant, because again. Like we said last week, it was made out of acacia wood. There's lots of forms of acacia in the Middle East. Some are nothing more than creosote bushes. They're like bushes, but some are, heavily trunked trees. And it's that you would derive acacia wood from. Obviously, there's acacia trees that, look like maple trees, kind of. And, so it's a very hard wood, but yet it's light at the same time. So it's kind of unique as far as just the wood is concerned. So it would be a great wood to build a piece of furniture out of, no question. It would last forever. If you want nice cabinets, you buy maple cabinets. And what do they make bowling floors out of and gym floors out of? Maple, because it lasts forever. that's what it's made out of. Now, you can see in general, not exactly the same, but in general, 2 cubits is going to be its length, a cubit its breadth, a cubit and a half its height. It's not a big table, but it's a table. And you're going to overlay it with pure gold, which is exactly the same as the Ark of the Covenant, excluding the lid. The lid is actually separate from the actual Ark itself. Arks don't have to have lids. As a matter of fact, if you look a little bit at history, Philo, Josephus, they'll even tell you the lid, the kaporet, had a hole in it. It wasn't even a solid. So is that true? I don't know. But, you can find those kinds of things. But, the point is that, there's a lot of similarities. And because it is in the Holy of Holies, it's in there. And so it has to be overlaid with gold. God's not going to touch it, but well, just for the podcast people, that's our fireplace going in the background. There's not gunshots going off, so
somebody in the backyard.
Right.
Again.
Yeah, hey, again. Yeah. But so you can see that we have the story in scripture where David is bringing the ark back from captivity from the Philistines, and they're not carrying it correctly. They're not carrying, priests aren't carrying it with the poles like it's supposed to be carried. They put it on an ox cart, okay? And here's Uzzah walking beside of it with another priest, and they're just walking beside of it. Well, they get close to the threshing floor. The ox stumbles. The cart starts to lean, and Uzzah reaches out to steady the ark, and God kills him because he touches it. This upsets David to no end. But and a lot of people would say, my goodness, Uzzah loved the ark. He loved the ark. He loved his Lord. He loved the ark. He was standing beside of it, making sure that, walking all the way, making sure that nothing happened to it. When it was about to hit the earth, he grabbed it. My goodness, come on, God, what are you doing? Well, the point is, the earth could not have defiled it, but his hands did. And so, Uzzah learned a lesson. Uzzah learned a lesson. Now,
So
did everybody else watching. And yeah, and David, for the longest time, sent it out to who was it? Obed-Edom. Obed-Edom sent it to his house, which Obed-Edom didn't touch it, and he flourished along with his house flourished. Until finally David said, okay, I think we've got our heads on straight now. Let's do it the right way and bring it into Jerusalem. So. But you can see that, once the once the very last thing was done to each one of these articles, that was the last time it was going to have human fingerprints on it. Wasn't going to be anymore, you know, because those poles were meant, they were meant to be carried by those poles. Mm. Now, the poles were always in the ark, but these poles were just removed from the table and only inserted whenever they wanted to move the table, which, you know, wouldn't have been very often. And as the priests walked into the whole, that holy place, the table of showbread would just be right on his right hand side. And so, you know, we're given that description too, where they are inside of the tabernacle, and that has to do with the story that the tabernacle tells as well. But we'll wait until we get the whole tabernacle, then we'll talk about that. But here's something interesting. You know, we introduced John Currid a while back. You may have forgotten him by now, but he wrote a book called Egypt in the Old Testament, and we've taken a lot of things from him. Heiser does too. And here, this is just something that's interesting. These are facts, because we always talk about the table of showbread, right? What the heck is showbread, and where did that term come from, you know? But yet you can read it in the Bible if in an English translation. Well, some English translations. But this is where it came from. Currid writes this: after having dealt with the only piece of sanctuary furniture in the Holy of Holies, the Ark, God now describes the nature of the furniture in the holy place, the next most sacred area, the tabernacle. As the priest entered the holy place, the table of showbread stood at his right-hand side. Martin Luther translated the Hebrew term for bread of presence as shabrot, okay, from which William Tyndale derived the word showbread. That's where it comes from.
It's like a nickname.
So it means nothing. It means absolutely nothing. That terminology is still quite common today. God's directives for the construction of the table of showbread are very similar to those given for the building of the ark, both to be made out of acacia wood, totally overlaid with pure gold, and have a gold border around them. The table of showbread is, like the Ark of the Covenant, to be carried by poles. Obviously, the purpose of these is similar as well, so that no human hand should touch the sacred furniture and thereby profane it. He goes on, but I'm going to stop right there. So, you know, there you have it. Now, the interesting thing is, if you look in the historical documents of Egypt, Mesopotamia, you know, particularly Ugaritic text, Babylonian text, you'll see that inside of a temple, and let's just take Egypt, you know, for example, because Egypt is, well, you know, it's where, you know, we're talking about the Egyptian gods. Well, in an Egyptian temple, you would see an ark, which is the covenant between the god and the people, somewhere right around the throne area, and this is the area. All Egyptian temples were built on an uphill slant. Okay, so as you walk into the temple, you're walking uphill. Pretty much, you know, that's just a way of saying, hey, I'm going up to the mountain, you know, where the god is. But so, you know, you walk in and you'll see this table, and this table has, you know, a feast on it, and it includes breads, it includes meats, it includes wine, you know, the flagons and the cups, the bowls, in other words. They're all there. And every single day, that table is completely filled with food to satisfy the god. Okay, so every day there's a feast of all those things, and the God comes and consumes them. Did that really happen? Probably not. But the problem is that, you know, they're doing it using the exact same implements, the exact same thing, but yet, see, they're doing it to satisfy their God. Okay, it's for their God to eat. Okay, and not just that, but you know, it has a full smorgasbord. It has everything on it, drinks and meats and everything on it. But as we walk into the tabernacle, you know, if we were used to seeing that and we walked into the tabernacle, we'd say, hey, what's the problem?
Where's all the rest of the stuff?
Where's all the rest of the stuff? And how come this bread has been sitting here for a whole week?
I like that.
Okay.
So they need to change it every day.
No. No. Well, the Egyptians do, yes. Yeah. Yes, you're right.
But this bread of presence is not changed every on the table regularly. Does it not change every day?
Only on the Sabbath.
Only on the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
So is the message from God is, I'm not needy.
Yes, it is.
What?
I'm not needy. I don't need anything.
From you.
Yeah.
From
good.
You. Right.
Good,
exactly.
Susan. Good. Good. Yes. Because, you know, as somebody look up Psalm 1.
Psalm 1?
Psalm 1. Oh, yeah.
My grandma knew that by heart.
Blessed is the man.
Blessed is the man. You want me to read it?
Oh, wait a minute. No, I'm talking about the wrong psalm here. Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah. Gosh. Wait a minute. It's the one that says, "If I were hungry, would I come and ask you? If I were, you know, would I come to?"
Yeah.
To get food from you or come to get fellowship from you? No, I wouldn't, you know. I wouldn't even tell you that I was hungry if I was hungry, you know. And so, you know, that's basically how God, you know, makes exclamation to his people. And so, you know, you can automatically just know that there's something else about this table than what we're used to seeing. Okay. If we go out into the pagan world, it's always trying to satisfy our God. That's the reason why you throw the virgin into the volcano mouth. It's the reason why, you know, why you sacrifice your sons and daughters and put them in the foundation of your house. It's the reason why you set this big feast table. Because so they can come and you know, it's always eating and drinking. They come, the gods come and they have a feast, a celebration. Okay, and it's all about them. And so they have these servants called people that service them, and so while they set up banquet, okay? And that's the way it works. And so, you know, you would expect there would be a table in their design. But you see, they're taking that design and they're distorting it to who they are, okay? Which are corrupt gods. So, now, even though the implement is exactly the same, how's it supposed to be used? That's the question. You know, how's it supposed to be used? Well, you know, it's not hard. It's not hard to figure out because, you know, we start seeing, you know, what's actually being done with the bread of presence, and the fact that this ritual only happens once every seventh day, as opposed to once every day. Okay, so that's something else that we're going to notice that's very different, and it happens with the Sabbath. Now, where do we get the Sabbath? Where does it come from? Where is the Sabbath really established?
The law creation.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
It's in the law. No
yeah,
question.
Yes,
you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's made formal
creation.
In the law, but it's creation.
Yeah.
So there's an obvious link between creation and this table.
Mm-hmm.
There's an obvious link. Okay. And so, you know, that's, if it's done regularly, if this is a covenant that's eternal, Barut Olam, that's Hebrew, eternal covenant. If that's what it is, then there's no question that this is representing creation. Now, you know, as we move from the tabernacle to the temple, it's going to be even more plain as to what this is. This is actually, I mean, I'm going to go ahead and spill the beans here. This is Eden. Okay. Well, this is a, that's right. This is a simulation of Eden. Okay. This is a sacred space where God dwells with his people, and it's Eden. It's getting back to Eden. Okay. And we talked about the fact that the world is anti-Eden and the kingdom of God is Eden. Okay. Anti-Eden, Eden. Chaos, order. Okay. Go ahead.
Mike, why was it that this place that represents God dwelling with his people, only such a small percentage could really go dwell with him? Mm-hmm. Or also, like, why weren't women allowed farther in, or like those types of things? Was that cultural, or was that, where does that come from?
No, it's not cultural.
Sacred space, though.
It's priest. Okay, it's about the priesthood. Okay. Who are we now? Now, after the death, burial, resurrection, ascension, reign of Jesus, who are we now? All of us in this room.
Priests.
We're all priests. Yeah. You know, we're all priests, okay? But because of the rebellion of the people, because initially Moses' original rebellion, I don't want to go, I don't want to do that, okay. Bring Aaron. You be the king. He'll be the priest. And it's split. Okay? And it remains split until Jesus' resurrection, when he brought the office back together again. He is now our priest king. He's made us a nation of priests. Okay? Instead of just Levi.
Okay?
So they had a set aside function to emulate the sacred space, and the sacred space now is going to eventually be made exactly the way it's supposed to function, not just under this temporary guise. Okay, and so since the Levites were men and the Levites were the priests, then that's who gets to come in and nobody else. Okay, because even if I am a man, if I'm not a Levite, there's many things I can't, there's a number of things I can't do, and there's a number of places I can't go.
Yeah.
Okay.
What about a female Levite? Why couldn't she be a priest?
Huh?
Because it just wasn't done. Yeah.
What did you say?
A female Levite.
A female Levite.
Yeah, like Miriam. Why couldn't Miriam be a priest? Okay.
So then that would be more cultural.
Hmm?
In a sense.
Well, you know, but
temple janitor.
But again, remember this, okay? Remember this, that in the culture there was the firstborn, and the firstborn was considered the male unless there wasn't any males, and then the firstborn is considered female. And God said specifically for, you know, the fellow that had only five daughters. That absolutely, they get the same treatment, you know. But if the male's there, no, you know, because they're going to leave the house. Okay, they're going to leave the house and they're going to join with another family. Okay, but the men stay in the house. Okay, it's the way, it's just, you know, culturally, it's the way it worked. And you can see that, you know, that's exactly what's going on. But and In the case of the five daughters, where they're going to inherit the land, they weren't allowed to marry anybody from any tribe. They had to marry within their own tribe so the land wouldn't leave the tribe. Because guess what? It's all about the land. It's all about the land.
Going back to Deuteronomy 32:8.
Exactly. It's all about the land. The land is the big deal. And again, we've talked about this before, but you know, even in Jesus' day, you can see that the Pharisees were more worried about the land than anything else. And actually, rightfully so, in a number of ways. They didn't want to sin because they didn't want to get exiled again. You know, they didn't want to go to Babylon. They didn't want someone coming and ripping them out of their homeland. And so there you have it, even though they were under, you know, the auspice of Rome.
So the Holy of Holies is in the farthest back part of
the
buildings?
It is.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I want to spend my prayer time just around, on the other side of the wall at the very back.
Yeah.
Which you can now.
Yeah.
Well, you could. You could have. Yeah, you could have.
So was the Court of Women, was that a...
That's a temple thing.
Got it. That's a tradition thing.
Mm-hmm. That's a temple thing. Right.
Not a Moses thing.
No.
Got it.
It's not. It's not. As a matter of fact, that could have been Herod the Great.
Could have been what?
Herod the Great.
Herod the not so great.
Mm-hmm.
Herod the
not so great. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, don't let those kinds of things slow you down. Because, you know, you've got to understand that, you know, again, this is all about Eden, you know, and yes, things are busted up. They're not the way they're supposed to be, but we are getting back there. Mm-hmm. You know, this is hope. You look at this and you say, I'm heading in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Not where I'm supposed to be yet, but I'm heading in the right direction. Okay. Okay. So let's see. Let me get back on track here. Here's another commentator that talks about, you know, these innovations that are coming because of the way this is being used. He says, also in regard to the table of the bread of presence, the religion of Israel made fundamental innovations and introduced important changes in the usage current in the ancient East. Okay, so he's saying, yeah, everybody else has these tables too, but, you know, among the neighboring peoples, the table, which was used for serving the offering to the gods, played an important role in the worship. In Mesopotamia, they would arrange the table, that the foods that had been prepared for the meal for the gods, such as boiled and roasted flesh, placed in dishes or plates, loaves of bread, jars of wine, milk and honey, various kinds of fruit, recalling the tables set before kings. Okay, so and you know, naturally so, that's you know what it's supposed to represent. The Egyptians practiced similar customs in the worship of their gods, and the other peoples of the countries of the East did likewise. The practice was based on the belief that the gods, who, like human beings, also needed food, and they actually ate and drank in some traditional manner, the foods and the drinks that were placed before them, like a king who eats and drinks before his servants, you know, as they set before the table. So there you go. I mean, that's what's going on. And so since God doesn't need any of that, then the showbread isn't consumed by God at all. As a matter of fact, who consumes the showbread? Well, it's the priests.
Yeah.
It's the priests. Now, does wine enter into the tabernacle? Yes, it does. You know, does roasted flesh enter into the tabernacle? Yes, it does. But where does it stop? It stops at the altar. Okay? Those things are poured out and burnt, consumed, not by God, not by human beings, by no one. And you know, the Bible says that God takes pleasure in the smell of those things. Okay? Not that he's consuming them, but he takes pleasure in the smell of those things. In other words, I don't need you to give me wine. I don't need you to give me meat. I don't need you to give me any of that stuff. You're sacrificing it. One of the things, as you read the whole Bible, one of the basic things about the whole feasts and sacrificial system is the fact that you can totally rely on God. Okay? If you couldn't, then why in the world would you take something that could sustain your family and burn it on an altar?
Exactly.
Why in the world would you leave your fields ripe, ready for harvest, and leave for 2 weeks and go celebrate, which every single feast required you to do? The wheat harvest, the barley harvest, you know, all those things, they happened at different times, and the festival called you away from those ripe fields and had you stay there for 2 weeks, basically, you know, traveling there and traveling back and the week long. And then you had to rely on God keeping your field safe, keeping it from marauders, keeping it from fire, keeping it from pestilence, keeping it from all kinds, yeah, hail, everything. You know, it could be completely destroyed and it was sitting there ripe for harvest when you left. But then you had to come back and had to rely on God to make sure that it's still there, it's still ripe, it's still ready to go. And that was life. That's life with God.
It still is.
And still is, yeah. It still is life with God. This sacred space allows you to come and dwell with God. It allows us to exercise the idea that God is all sufficient, and so therefore now we know what the table of the bread of presence is all about. It's about creation. It's about our Creator God. It reminds us that He's the God of the Sabbath, okay? And it reminds us that He is the God, He's the provider. He's the provider of all things. There's the bread that sustains me, and it's replaced every Sabbath day, which reminds me that He's my Creator. He's the Creator and Establisher of all things. Mark?
Does it tie into the manna in the wilderness at all? The showbread?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the manna in the wilderness represents exactly the same thing. Yeah. Yeah.
And God, our provider.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you had to trust that on the sixth day to be twice as much.
That's right. Right.
It's interesting, too, to think about it in light of the New Testament and Christ, because He eats the bread, breaks mm-hmm. the bread, and eats it with the disciples before He dies, mm-hmm. calls Himself the bread of life.
Yes, mm-hmm. that's right. And, no coincidence.
Yeah,
right, that is no coincidence. You're right.
It's cool how it all...
That's right, how it all ties together.
Together.
Now, if anyone would have eaten any of the food improperly off of the other gods' tables, they would have died, okay? And they wanted to kill David and his men when they came into the temple and ate the bread of presence, but God said, that's what it's for, you know? This isn't about ritual. This it is a ritual happening, but it's not... If you look in Scripture, there's several times where, you know, we actually get offended because we as Americans say, well, these are the rules, you can't break the rules, okay? But, you know, when God's people just started practicing Passover again, there were some that were taken by surprise, weren't clean, weren't in the right state of mind, weren't in the right place. And you know, they practiced the Passover anyway. And God said, I see their hearts, that's cool. I'm fine with that. Okay. The same thing with David and his men eating the showbread, you know, the bread of presence. God said, I'm cool, I'm fine with that. I see their hearts. I know what's going on. Jesse.
What would you say to somebody who said it seems like a double standard, because you have the guy who, I'm going to stop the ark,
mm-hmm.
and his heart was, I want to protect the ark.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, he's a priest and he should have known better,
mm-hmm.
but he gets struck dead, and then there's the guy who's carrying a backpack on the Sabbath, and they kill him,
mm-hmm.
but then you get David who's violating it, and it's okay.
Well, that's the key word that you just said, violation. There was no violation with David, but there was a violation with Uzzah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So there wasn't an established rule that mm-hmm. a person couldn't eat the showbread.
Yeah, everybody knew those implements couldn't be touched by human fingers.
The ark, you meant.
The ark,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
But there was no such thing about the bread.
No, not at all. Not at all.
It got eaten anyway.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. it did.
And
that's right.
The priest gave it to David.
Yeah, The priest gave it away. So, no, there was no violation at all.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the priest gave it to David, but David couldn't go up and take it off the table.
Well, David probably wouldn't have gone up
he,
and taken it off
the table.
He would
have known better.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
He couldn't have gone in the Holy
Place. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, yeah. So let's go to, let me just read you Leviticus 24:5-9. Okay. Here's what it says. This is about the bread, the table of presents. You shall make fine flour and bake 12 loaves from it. So we know now there's 12 loaves, and each loaf represents one of the 12 tribes. From it, 2/10 of an ephah shall be in each loaf. And actually, that's a lot of flour. These loaves of bread were pretty big, actually. But, you know, and that's the reason why they're in piles, because the table wouldn't have, you couldn't just lay them side by side. The table wouldn't have held them. There's two piles. They're just piled up. And you shall set them in two piles, six in a pile, on the table of pure gold before the Lord. And you shall put pure frankincense on each pile, that it may go with the bread as a memorial portion, as a food offering to the Lord. Every Sabbath day Aaron shall arrange it before the Lord regularly. There's that word again. Okay. Ritual. Okay. Ritual. It is from the people of Israel as a covenant forever, and it shall be for Aaron and his sons. There, you, now you're getting the gist of it. It's not for me. You're not offering it to me. Okay, it's simply a ritual that says I'm your creator and I'm your sustainer. Okay, it's a ritual, and that's the reason why we do liturgical things in church life. And even in our own lives. It's the reason why we said, oh, you know, gosh, I haven't prayed. You know, I need to pray, you know. It's a ritual kind of thing. Because, and Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me. As often as you do this in remembrance of me. It's a ritual kind of thing. Now, I don't like to take liturgy as far as a lot of people take liturgy, because then you become robotic. But the point is, though, regularly. In other words, you have been created as a person who resets. You reset every night as you go to sleep and wake back up again. You reset every year. Okay. You reset after major events in your life. You do that, and God understands the way He makes us, and so therefore there is a ritual made in the tabernacle area, so that we continue to be reminded of the things that we will forget. Remember, Agar in Proverbs 30 says, Lord, don't make me so poor that I'll steal and defile your name, and don't make me so rich that I'll forget who you are. Okay? And that's what this is all about. That's the reason why regularly it's done. That's the reason why it wasn't just done once. And, you know, the legend is, and again, this is legend, but the legend is the showbread stayed hot and fresh all week.
That's what I wanted to know. Like, so those poor priests had to eat week-old bread.
Stale.
They were, the legend is, it was as hot and fresh as it came out of the oven.
Can you eat frankincense?
I was just thinking the same thing.
Or did they just, the frankincense in the top, did they burn that piece? Or can you eat frankincense?
Yeah, you can.
Didn't sound like that.
That's
like a sap, isn't it?
Yeah.
Essential oils with frankincense.
Yeah, well, I tell you, it sure does smell good, though.
It does.
Yeah, oh, my.
It's very strong, though.
It's very strong, yeah.
You have to put it in those little capsules to get it down.
You can put it in a capsule.
Well, it's really good for you.
Yeah, it's really good for you.
Bread.
Yeah.
Interesting. You can put essential oil in it. That's really good.
Okay, let me. there's a commentator named Gane, G-A-N-E, and he says this. Furthermore, there is the bread of presence ritual, a positive redefinition of bread laying by linking the bread to the Sabbath and thus to creation. It is suggested, therefore, that the bread represents the concept that Yahweh is Israel's resident creator provider, who, like other ancient Near Eastern deities, acknowledges no dependence on human food. Remember, we just talked about the fact that God and his people came together at Mount Sinai. God invited his people into his house, and God didn't eat, but his people did. Okay? There's only one exception, that's Genesis 18, where, you know, he came, God, Jesus, the angel of the Lord, came into the people's house, okay, Abraham's tent, and Abraham fed him, and he ate there. That's the single exception. The single exception. But again, that wasn't God, that was God traveling to you, not you coming into God's house. Okay? God doesn't eat when you come to see him.
So how do all these Asian restaurants when you go into, they have Buddha there and they have all this food?
Yes.
In front, how do they explain to themselves how this food never gets eaten?
Like, why would you worship a God that can't eat its own food?
Well, yeah, no, that's good, Gloria. That's true. And you know, you think about what happened to the food in Egypt. Every single day a banquet was placed there. And
how do you explain that in your own mind?
There's a legend story, I forget which book I read it in, that I think it was Abraham. So one of them proved that by dust all over the floor at night and the next day going in, of course all the food's gone, but if you look in the dust you see men's footprints. Mm-hmm. The priests were eating.
Yeah.
So,
If you were doing that in Washington, D.C., how many senators would be there at night, you know, chomping down on that food? Of course there would be. It got ate.
I think it's interesting, too. I keep thinking about when Jesus came after the resurrection and he comes back and he says, I'm hungry. How cool that is for him to declare, hey, I'm God, but I'm man.
And I eat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So why, if they did this every Sabbath, why didn't we keep that up in modern day time?
Well,
temple's gone.
Yeah, temple's gone.
Temple's gone.
Yeah.
No, the same thing. I guess I didn't say that right. I meant, that word would left me. When we had the Lord's Supper.
Oh, yes. Okay.
You know, why aren't we, isn't that kind of like this? Or not?
Well, sort of, yes. However, remember this, you know, the ritual has been taken out. Jesus said two main things, and those two main things allow us to understand that, okay, the ritual's been taken out of it as far as the temple and the tabernacle is concerned, because he said, you know, whatever you seal on earth, it'll be sealed in heaven. Okay, so you make the decision how often you're going to practice the Lord's Supper, and heaven will agree with you, but you better stick to your word. And the other thing too is as often as you do it. So it's open-ended.
I got you now.
Okay, it's open-ended.
So the Baptist convention, they do it quarterly, right?
Yeah.
Well, they can, yeah, that's right.
I just thought that's funny how we just inadvertently fell into that pattern where usually about once a quarter we'll all celebrate it together.
But there's some churches that do it every Sunday.
Yeah,
Church of Christ.
Yeah, I grew up
Church of Christ, Christian Church.
Of course, yeah.
Cracker, though.
Yeah, and anybody who is anywhere near, Catholicism, Lutheran, I mean, you know, you and then Reformed, you know, you back up those three steps and you'll see. Every single week, you'll see the Lord's Supper. The Eucharist. Yeah.
There it gets down to be robotic.
Well, I mean, Sharon, I would say don't say that only because, you know, doggone it, there are some people that their heart's right and they go every week and they do it right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's some people in the Southern Baptist Church that, it's that time of that time of the year again. Here we go. Whatever that's about, you know. I mean, but, you know, if you talk to someone in the Southern Baptist Church, they'll say, we only do it that often because it's very special and very sacred, and we're not going to just do it over and over and over again because our people will just get used to it and they'll just quit thinking about it. And then you'll talk to someone in like the Catholic Church and they'll say, hey, the gospel, the Eucharist is central to the gospel. Why would we take that out of our service? And how could you argue with that? You know, you couldn't argue with that.
Seems right to them.
Yeah, sure.
Heaven agrees with both of them.
Heaven agrees with both of them. Yes, they do.
It's the heart.
Yeah, it's the heart.
Both
yeah.
to honor God.
Yeah. So there you have it. Cool. Yeah. Gosh, you know, it's 12 o'clock and I only got through one thing.
Bread.
Yeah. I got kind of hung up on bread. Well, you know, should I go ahead and just quickly go through?
Yeah, quickly.
Okay, quickly. Very quickly. Okay. Yeah. Let me get here. Gosh.
So this table isn't in the holy place. It's outside.
No, it's in the holy place.
It's not in the holy of holies.
With the ark.
It's in the holy place. Yeah. The ark is all by itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So picking up in verse 31 then, it says this, "You shall make a lampstand of pure gold. The lampstand shall be made of hammered work. Its base, its stems, its cups, its calyxes, and its flowers shall be of one piece with it. And there shall be six branches." Okay, that's a really poor translation. "Six branches going out of its sides, three branches of the lampstand out of one side and three out of the lampstand on the other side of it. Three cups made like almond blossoms, each with calyx and flower on one branch, and three cups made like almond blossoms, each with calyx and flower on the other branch. So for the six branches going out of the lampstand." Okay. And then, you know, it goes on to explain it further. "You shall make, you know, seven lamps for it. The lamps shall be set up so as to give light on the space in front of it, its tongs." I'm not going to read everything about it, but the point here is that, you know, there's this big fight among scholars that says, does it have six lights or does it have seven? Okay, and you can read at times in the Bible where it has seven. So the main stem has a light on it, and the six tubes, or what is properly called reeds, hollow tubes, come out instead of branches. Okay, now most of the time you'll hear, and you know, I waffle on this. Most of the time you'll hear that the menorah, the gold lampstand, is, if you're talking about the fact that now you're talking about Eden inside of the room there, that this is the tree of life. It represents the tree of life. But remember this, and you know, I'm not gonna die on that hill, I'm not gonna argue with it, but I'm pretty convinced now that it has nothing to do with the tree at all. It has everything to do with, you guessed it, light. Okay? Because this is a room that represents creation. It represents the Creator. What's the first thing? Mm-hmm. Let there be light. Mm-hmm. What does it say that it's actually for? "The lamp shall be set up so as to give light on the space in front of it." Why didn't the text say it shall represent the tree of life? Okay? Mm-hmm. Here's the deal. Again, you look out into ancient Near Eastern texts, and you see that tree symbols are a part of culture and worship, but the trees always had animals around its base. Always, it was never formed without lions or, you know, a giraffe or whatever around its base, and it reached up, and there were heavenly symbols and signs in its branches, okay? Again, there's no leaves. Yes, there's flower, calyx, yeah, no question, but that's the almond bud. Now you would say, well, Mike, you know, that says it's an almond tree, right? Well, yeah, again, still, you know, it is not the Hebrew word for branch. It's the Hebrew word for reed. Okay, and so I think the main thing about this particular object is the light that it gives. Now, the point here is that the Levitical priests were responsible for trimming the wicks and putting the olive oil in it each and every day. Some people say that it only burned at night. Some people say it burnt 24/7. Most agree that it burnt as long as it had fuel to burn. It went out, and when the next priesthood moved in, they trimmed the wicks, filled the oil back up, and they did that at exactly the right precise time. So it did right at dusk when the third star could be seen. It was lit and burning. And, you know, during the morning sacrifice, it was lit, retrimmed, lit, and burning. And that was the only time that it was necessary to be burning, because, again, when the sacrifices were going on, the light that represented God needed to be shining.
Okay. So there was oil in those lamps.
Yeah.
That one looks like it's got candles. Would be for candles.
Yeah. No. There's the all those little little pods hold oil. So you pull the wick out, you pour the oil in, and you put the wick back down.
Oh,
in it.
I got you.
And you trim the wick.
Uh-huh.
You know, you trim it too.
Oh,
you know.
Get you.
So okay. That's what the priest's job was for.
I get you.
Like the little kids' Sunday school.
Thought,
give me
your... Yeah, keep it burning. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm.
Could it be like a burning bush type thing, or do you don't think that's the point?
That has been argued.
And fire tree, presence of God.
Exactly. That has been argued. But, and yes, that's out there. You will find that. In scholarship, you will find that. But... most agree, because of the table of presence, most agree, the main thing about this is the light that it gives. God is light.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the only source of light. There's no other source
right.
of light than God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this represents.
Now, I've forgotten where this stands compared to the table. In the courtyard.
Right across.
Courtyard.
No,
inside
the holy place.
Inside the holy place.
It's on the left-hand side. Okay, if the priest
table.
Would move into the end of the room, right in the middle, he'd have the showbread on his right and the menorah on the
okay,
left.
Okay, gotcha.
You ready? All right. So, okay, you can come and peek down if you want to see it. Okay, but the priest would enter in this area right here is called the holy place, and this is the holy, and they're separated by curtains. And he would walk in, menorah would have been lit here. Now, this is all plated gold. Can you imagine how pretty that would have been?
Wow.
Yeah, the glow of the gold. So you have the table here. Okay.
Yeah, there's the bread.
Got his bread on there. And you got your menorah. Okay. And then you got a priest standing there. And then the altar of incense we'll do next time. And it's standing before this curtain. And remember, the curtains are woven with
cherubim
to remind the priest as he's standing there praying that there's a separation between man and the presence of God now.
Come past that curtain.
Yeah, because that's the presence of God there, back to Eden, okay?
Yeah.
The cherubim guarded the Garden of Eden with the flame, okay? And that's all. That's it's just nice and nice little room there. And then you've got the ark in behind there.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that makes sense.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can peek in there and see them all. But
right.
It would.
Then you got all these dead.
Then you got all these dead animals out here.
Is
that my granddaughter?
The biggest 24.
Mm-hmm. So they, as Tessa says it, the animal comes through the gate and they. Burn it and cook it, and then we put it on the table and eat it, and then we go wash our hands, and then we go in and thank God. That's her way of describing the whole thing.
Yeah.
And what kind of barbecue sauce did they use?
What kind of what?
Barbecue sauce.
I don't know. they did burn the frankincense.
A1 frankincense.
And there was there's a group that goes around. It wasn't that long ago. They came to Chandler, and we took the kids and went down, and they do the exact replica to scale of this.
Wow.
And they take you through, and you get to, they don't kill animals, but they walk you through the whole thing, teach you everything. And I have to admit, I was really, really surprised how small
this room was. Yeah. Now, of course, I'm sure it's bigger in Solomon's temple, but maybe so. But this, it was a small little room that we were in. Wow. And it only took so many in at a time. And they didn't let us go inside there. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it was pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
Thank you for showing this to us. This is really neat.
And it's cool.
So there's usually only one priest at a time going.
Yeah, only one priest at a time can go in there.
Mm-hmm.
And on the morning prayers and the evening prayers, he would take the coals, the ashes, the hot ashes from here. So we've got the blood drip down on it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He would take it in his censer, which is like a, you know, bowl type of a thing. He would go wash off, okay? Then he would go in, put the hot coals on this. This is the place of prayer.
Mm.
The golden altar. This is bronze. This is
gold. Altar of incense is what it's called. Yeah.
And he would put those ashes on there, and then he put incense in there, and he would offer his morning prayers and the evening prayers on behalf of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Zechariah was doing when the angel came and said, "You're going to have a baby boy."
That's right.
You're what?
You're going to have a baby boy, John the
mm-hmm.
Baptist.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's where he was. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So he was standing there. Okay. Make sense now?
Yep.
Smell like frankincense and barbecue.
There
yeah,
you go.
Yeah.
Yep.
But now, remember, we said it just briefly last week. The sacrifice, as Mike said today, the sacrifices were not for God to eat.
Mm-hmm.
But the priest, I mean, it was the feast
yeah.
for the priest. It was a celebration time.
Wow.
Because remember, it wasn't for atonement. It was for creating this place that
mm-hmm.
God would dwell with them.
Create sacred space. That's what you're doing.
In one of my classes, my professor led us through a short meditation or visualization of what it would have been like in this place.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to bring you guys through if you have energy for like 5 minutes to close your eyes and picture it.
Okay.
If you're open to it still.
Yeah.
You still
yeah,
have some
yeah.
yeah.
Let me.
Okay.
Yeah, and I have something I want to share too afterwards. So.
Okay. Well, let me go ahead and end the audio here because we're already past an hour. So we'll do that and we'll just continue together. So here we go.